This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and who expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think. Unregistered is still a completely listener-supported podcast. So, if you want to keep the show going, I need your help. To make a contribution, you can go to unregisteredlisteners.com. You'll receive access to the private Unregistered Facebook page where I discuss the ideas from the show with listeners. You'll also receive gifts of Unregistered merchandise, transcripts of the interviews, autographed copies of my books, webinars on history, politics, culture, and philosophy, and a download of my 11-part video lecture course on A Renegade History of the United States. I really hope you can help me keep these remarkable conversations going. There's another way you can participate directly in conversations with me, like the ones on the podcast. There are still a few tickets left for a special weekend event with me in Salem, Massachusetts on August 5th and 6th. You can get all the information for the event at thaddeusrussell.com/courses/weekend. My guest this week was on his way to becoming a professor. He studied creative writing and organismic and evolutionary biology for several years at the University of Massachusetts, but he decided to ditch a career in academia to do much more interesting things. In recent years, he's become a prominent public intellectual and has written some of my very favorite essays on sexuality, philosophy, and on his own highly unorthodox life. If you're a gay man, you probably know of him, but for very different reasons. Connor Habib is a star performer in gay pornographic films. He's also one of very few bona fide sex radicals living in the United States. Connor recently started his own web series called Against Everyone with Connor Habib, which you can support through his Patreon site. So I'm in the house of Connor Habib, and it's in Hollywood's lovely house. And I'm just going to put this on the table right now so that we can get it over with and move on. Connor's a gay porn star and has been a gay porn star for how long again?
8 years, going on 9.
And full-time for much of that?
Like, for a lot of it was full-time. Now it is not really full-time. It's just sort of an occasional thing I do. But gay porn is, you know, it's like being a little bit in gay porn is sort of like being a little pregnant. Like, you either are a gay porn performer or you're not.
Well, but wait, but being pregnant is not eternal. Don't you mean it's eternal? Like, once you're a gay porn star, you're always one?
Yeah, well, that is true now. There is no... There's that, remember this idiotic documentary, After Porn Ends? There is no After Porn Ends Now.
You can never escape.
You do it, and yeah. That's that. Well,
yeah, I mean, it's certainly true that you'll probably always be identified as such by others, right? Mm. Yeah. But so we're here in his house, and it's lovely. And I have been stalking Connor a little bit from afar because I noticed that, you know, there are a lot of gay porn stars out there, but there aren't... any that I'm aware of, maybe you know some, who think like this guy here. And I was really attracted to the way he thinks about certain things, in particular sexuality, but really politics and culture generally. And so I was kind of stalking him, following him on Twitter, reading his stuff, and I guess you could say flirting. I don't want to go down that road too far, but you know, I was trying to like say things nice to him on Twitter, etc. And he never responded. He never gave me any love back as far as I could tell, although I think you followed me. That was exciting. But otherwise, I got no response from you, so I didn't know what was going on. Finally, I got this podcast going. Then I'm somebody. Then he'll talk to me. So he's here. Finally got him. No, we met last week, and we tried to record a podcast, and it failed miserably because I'm a moron when it comes to technical stuff, and it was a disaster. However, I thought, and I think you thought, that it was actually a good thing because so much came up. It felt to me like you were like a racehorse let out of its barn. Like you were just so ready to go, ready to run in places you're not allowed to run often, or just where you don't feel like someone's going to hear you. And it seemed that way to me. And so it just came bursting out of you, and it was really, really thrilling to me. And I felt like we had so much common ground, and where we disagreed, it was just really interesting as well. It wasn't just a fight. So we saw it as a rehearsal, and we're back, and this one's going to stick because I have a real sound guy this time. And I'm so excited about this. So yeah, let's get this over with. He's a gay porn star. That was his major, only occupation for quite a while, right? That was your only form of income?
Basically, yeah. I mean, I was writing, but I'm publishing, but the writing wasn't my main livelihood. So yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's stop talking about that. For now, at least, and move on to I guess I would actually say that you being a gay porn star, believe it or not, maybe the least interesting thing about you.
Well, that is, I think, a nice thing to say. The thing about being a sex worker or porn performer is it teaches you a lot about everything else. And so I was already interested in all kinds of shit already, you know. It's going to be funny because you and I are going to sort of rehearse. We're going to go over again some of the things we talked about last time, but nobody knows we talked about last time because that was sucked into the void. But, you know, one of the things is I was sort of on track to be a college English professor. I was an English instructor and at University of Massachusetts and Western New England College, which is now Western New England University. And so I was really involved in humanities. I was also studying the sciences in grad school. So I'm the sort of person who is really interested in everything. So what gay porn essentially did for me, and being a sex worker did for me, is it sort of clarified a lot of the views that I was interested in, a lot of the perspectives I was interested in a lot of different ways. So however it fits in there, it's definitely informed everything else that that I care about.
Oh, no, certainly. It's just, you know, I'm always... So I had a guest on earlier, Camille Foster, who's, you know, according to Americans, a black guy, no doubt about it, but he doesn't want to identify as black, and that's kind of one of his big things, is like it's a social construct, and social constructs are what, you know, have limited people historically in all sorts of ways, so let's do that. Let's not... So he hates... I hate, and I said this on that episode, you know, I hate watching, which happens all the time, white people expecting, basically forcing black people to talk about being black. And so, you know, I know that you, because we've talked about this, you know, you don't have that kind of feeling about being identified as a porn star, but you're kind of trying to move beyond it, and you're sort of more interested in other stuff, and you do get asked about that all the time.
It's more than I just get asked the same 10 questions all the time about it. And it's because there's such a, I mean, in some ways sort of deservedly so, because there's such a line between everybody is engaged with pornography in one way or another in our culture. Right. And so there's such a line between what people know about porn and what's true about porn. And there's a lot of reasons for that line, but people end up asking me very similar questions all the time. And to me, they're not the interesting questions. Like, so, you know, they'll be like, is there anything you wouldn't do on camera? Like, they ask me questions like that. Like, do you get to pick your scene partners? How do you, you know, those sorts of things. And it's not, you know, those are questions that people want the answers to. So I'm happy to answer them. I just get tired of doing those again and again and again. And I think that there's a lot, you know, there's a lot I'd like to talk about that isn't about the sort of false starting place that a lot of people are at when they're asking me.
Which is what? What's the false starting place?
Well, like, you know, a lot of questions about porn start with like, well, so, I mean, it's altering young boys' behavior. So how do we blah, blah, blah? Like, how do you talk about pornography with your kids? Or like, aren't you know, like, how do we have, how, this is a good one, this is a sneaky one, like, how do we have ethical porn? You know, it's like, wait a second, you know? Right. So it's always, it always starts from that realm, you know? And it could be anti-porn, or it could be just ignorance, or it could be just boring, you know?
Or in the case of the ethical question, unwittingly anti-porn, right?
That's what I mean,
they
yeah.
don't know they're anti-porn,
right?
But they are.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, so... So anyway, now of course I'm like stretching my mind thinking, okay, God, what are the 10 questions? Don't be that asshole, Dad. Ask the interesting question.
You can ask me the 10
so
questions.
So just throw
fine.
Something at me if I do. Just hit me. Anyway, I want to just sort of table that. I want to put that out there to let everyone know what we're dealing with here. But table it for the moment.
What kind of monster we're dealing
exactly.
with.
Exactly. Well, that is actually the question in a sense, which is, so we're in Hollywood, California, and you're a gay porn star, but you sure didn't start there.
Right.
And that's hell of a journey. So, you know, and that's what this podcast is about in a sense, is how people get, from birth to where they are now, professionally, politically, ideologically and intellectually, culturally, et cetera. So that's why I want to stop talking about you being a porn star now and start talking about how you think you got there. Like, where did that start? Do you think? And of course, it's not always possible to locate origins of things, but
yeah.
I know when we talked last week, you did have some ideas about that, which were fascinating. Yeah.
I was just grabbed by five guys and thrown in a van, and then now
that's what
just
I heard. Yeah, that's what I heard. That's typical. I mean, for most, not all.
Just
yeah.
you know, the typical human trafficking experience.
Yeah.
So where would you like to start?
Well, no, I mean, here's where I want to start. So you're from a small town in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
Which one?
It's called Catasauqua, which I believe means land of the drought, although there were not droughts there. Land of little rain, something like that.
So you felt, you told me that you felt an outsider in many ways.
Yes.
In that town. And that, I think you were talking about how that it was probably in some sense the origin of where you are now. Because you're an outsider. I mean, you being a gay porn star is actually kind of the least of how you're an outsider, because you
sure.
think so differently than pretty much anyone.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Well, I grew up in small town Pennsylvania, sort of post-industrial wasteland, although I grew up in the nice part of the post-industrial wasteland, and you know, very small town. My graduating class was 90 people. My father is a Syrian immigrant, and you know, which I didn't really understand at first when I was a kid, you know. And my mom is from Buffalo, New York, and so it was, there's difference just by being born, right? So the sort of
being brown, you mean?
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. But being from an interracial family, mm-hmm. you know, my dad is very dark skinned, and but I'm not. I mean, people, they'll think I'm Italian, or you know, whatever.
Mexican. What's that Mexican guy doing?
Yeah, right. Right. Whatever they think I, whatever they believe I am, and so. And so there was difference right off the bat. There was difference because, you know, my father wasn't really playing sports with me. You know, he's not from Damascus, from a village in the mountains. Hmm. And so it was just sort of like he had this whole sort of folk way of his life, you know, and I didn't. And so I didn't play sports. And of course, those are really important in the little white suburban town.
I didn't find this out. How did he end up in small town Pennsylvania?
It, you know what? I wish I actually knew the answer, because I know he was sort of ahead of the game. There is a big Syrian population near where I grew up now, but I think he was pretty early in on that. In fact, there's a Syrian American society in the town I grew up in, so there's that big of a presence. Yeah. And that's where later, when I got older, I would set up punk rock shows, because I...
Punk rock shows? I didn't know about this.
Yes, I set
the
up...
The plot just continues to thicken.
I know, so I set up punk rock shows there at the Syrian American Society, because you know, I was bored, and so I would just call booking agents and bands that I liked and be like, will you play in Catasauqua, Pennsylvania, and we'll pay you this percentage of the door. And then I started a record label, but that's all much later.
God. I didn't know any of that.
I know. That's a, that was when I was like 18. But there is a sort of a direct connection in the sense of, I mean, punk rock at a certain point became the sustaining, like it was like the thing that kept me alive in a lot of ways. I mean, all kinds of art, but the spirit of punk rock especially, and its sort of defiant, almost utopian idea of what we could be and who we could be.
I think we might have some differences there.
Well, you, just so you all know, the last time we talked, I brought up a utopian thinker, and
he
balked at that too.
Yeah.
So we might get into utopias today.
Yeah, let's do that too.
I'm all about utopias.
Wow, okay, got to track back now because we're already losing control of the narrative. So your dad, what did he do?
He's a contractor, and so he built houses, did developments, all that kind of stuff, and I believe he's still doing that.
Okay. So, broadly speaking, middle class?
Yeah, and then when my parents got divorced, my mom really did not accept a lot of money, so we were poor, but I didn't know it. My mom was teaching, and she was, and we lived with her most of the time. We also went to his house. You know, I mean, she stayed in the same town. So we went to his house like every other weekend and like one day a week. But she was teaching, and she was also selling encyclopedias door to door. And she was just busy all the time. So it's me and my sister living with my mom. And she would do this thing where she would take us to McDonald's, and she would get us food, and like she would take a bite of my sister's food, knowing that my sister was going to say, "Now, why'd you take a bite out of mine? You didn't take a bite out of his," you know. And then she would take a bite out of mine to like, and then she would keep evening it out. And I didn't realize she was eating, like that was her eating, because she didn't have enough money to pay for food for herself. And I didn't realize that gravy bread, which was bread with gravy on it, was a poor person food, you know. So she really sort of managed that. And then we'd go to my dad's, and my dad had all this money. He didn't have a ton of money, but he wasn't rich, but he had a lot.
It's funny. I just have to say this. It's so similar to my childhood.
Oh, really?
My parent. When did they divorce?
When I was 7.
Yeah, I was 5.
Yeah.
And my father had a stable job as a computer programmer. And never wealthy, but solidly middle class, always had a decent, nice house in the sort of hills in Berkeley. And my mother and stepfather were professional revolutionaries, which meant they were broke and really poor. So like, you know, the guy from the credit card company came to our house with a big scissors and cut the credit card right in front of my mother. And
wow.
And, you know, I remember being her getting busted at the grocery store for bouncing a check. Or trying to pass off a check or something like that. And, you know, they made a combined $11,000 a year. I know that in 1978, because I saw their tax return that year when I was a kid. But I was going back and forth between these worlds, right? And so it was like the kind of wealthy or middle-class white kids in the hills. And then it was kind of, my mother and stepfather lived in basically what is the ghetto of Berkeley. It's not like a hard hood, but it is definitely like a mostly black neighborhood, working class and poor. And, I think you and I talked about this actually, like there was some shame for me around that. Like, cause I didn't want the wealthy kids, my wealthy white friends, to know about my other life. And I didn't really want the kids on Otis Street to know about the kids in the hills either. So I was always embarrassed about either one. Right. Cause in Berkeley, there's like this reverse snobbery, right? If you're rich, you're bad. And it's actually good to be poor. It's the virtue of poverty. Like one of the reasons I hate that idea so deeply, because I was always going back and forth. I was always a liminal figure, a term Connor definitely knows, but many people don't know, which means, you know, someone who's sort of in the margins or on the margins, who's not of one category or another, but sort of goes between two or multiple categories. Anyway.
Or as you would say, if we're talking about gender, it's its own category.
Sure. Yeah. Yes. Right. Which I just that's what I just did. I actually made it its own category, didn't I? By placing myself in this thing. Anyway. So sounds similar. So your dad was sort of middle class,
yeah,
and your mother was struggling and on the edge.
And we didn't know. And then actually, you know, a really important moment in my whole sort of journey was right around that time. Two things happened, and I think you'll find fascinating. The other will freak you out.
Oh, good.
The first one, the fascinating one, or the one I think you'll find fascinating, is I saw porn when I was 7. Right. So right after they got divorced, my dad got this big screen TV, very impressive, you know, huge, big by today's standards, unless I'm just remembering that wrong because I was so small. Mm-hmm. But and we had a cable cheater box, and which is like you would steal the neighbor's cable. Right. And so we had a remote control that just went up and down, right? Plus, minus. And it was me, the woman who became my stepmother, and my sister sitting on the couch, and he was pressing plus, 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 plus. And on channel 27, which was the porn channel, at that moment, the battery in the remote control died. So when you flip past the channels very quickly, it was just, you couldn't even see an image because it was so quick. But when he hit channel 27, the battery in the control died. And just on this giant screen was this giant dick and this giant pussy, and it was just slammed.
And it was
slam,
stuck
slam.
There.
Yes.
It was stuck on that channel.
Totally.
On the porn channel. And, ever since, you've been stuck on the porn channel.
Yes, exactly. My sister screamed and covered my eyes. My stepmom screamed. And my dad ran up and turned the TV off. And I remember, you know, like this really symbolizes a lot of, I mean, it really just encapsulates the Western mind when it comes to sex, which is, look, here's this thing that's completely available to everybody, and it's obviously there for a reason to be seen, but don't look at it.
Right.
Right. And the tension, sexual tension and eroticization comes from the tension between those two things. Yeah. And from then on, I've been into that. But also, I think, you know, a big part of my mission has been to sort of remove that, like to change that, okay, sort of get us out of that. So that's one thing. So my sister's covering my face and trying to prevent me from seeing something that I didn't know I was supposed to see. So that's my big question, is what is it that we are not supposed to see? And the other thing that happened around then, and maybe this was like,
this was straight porn, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Gay porn came later.
What would have happened if it had been stuck on the gay porn? The house would have burned down.
Yeah. I'd be a school shooter. right. So I the other thing that happened is I think maybe this is a year later, and I was really obsessed with cataloging when I was a kid. I would just make lists of things. I made lists of animals. I made lists of superheroes. I'd write their names or I would just draw them, just sort of like as if I were making encyclopedias. And my brother had this Dungeons and Dragons obsession, right? And so I read his Dungeons and Dragons books when I was a kid, these monster manuals that had all the names of the different monsters. And in one of those monster manuals were the names of all the sort of devils and demons. And I remember sort of cataloging those in my mind. I memorize all of them. I know like every animal because I had these things called safari cards. I would memorize every kind. Like that was something I was really invested in, was memorizing things. Mm-hmm. And so I was in the backyard sort of just playing, hanging out. And I said the name of one of the devils. And I heard this roar behind me. It was not an animal. It was not a, I don't know what it, I mean, well, I know what it was now. I have my ideas on it now. But at the time, it was this sound, this unearthly, horrifying sound. And it was a growl and a scream and a shout at the same time. And I ran inside crying. And that also is a moment that stays with me. So really, I'm the worst. Every mother's fear from the 1980s, I'm all that's realized, which is Dungeons and Dragons leads to the devil and porn leads to becoming a prostitute, right? So I'm encapsulate all
well
that.
Well done.
Yes. So those are two really big moments around that time in my life that stuck with me. You know, there are other moments too. I started writing when I was a kid, right around, again, same time. It was a really big time in my development. Started writing a novel when I was like 8 years old.
Gosh.
And my mom got an Apple IIc computer, and I started writing this fantasy novel. Because I would read these really big books, these like 500-page novels when I was in elementary and middle school, and I started writing this fantasy novel. So that was a big thing too. So all these things happening at this time where you know, I mean, your teeth have just finished falling out, or your permanent teeth are just developing, and I'm just having all this shit happen.
Mm-hmm. Now, I would say the mainstream psychologist's first take would be, Connor, this all seemed to coincide with the divorce.
Yes, totally. Of course. Which seemed very, went very smoothly. And I actually didn't even really know what was happening. I had my birthday party and someone bought me a book called I think it was called Benjamin Bunny Moves to a New House. And I was like, oh, and the woman, she was a babysitter. She's like, that's because you're moving. I was like, we're moving? Mm. I didn't know. So it was another thing that my mom had sort of kept repressed. So yeah, I think sure it has a lot to do with that. But I also think that that time in people's life is always big. I think 7, 8 is always a big time for people. And part of it is the physical transition, the hardening of your bones, the sort of the kind of growth that starts around then, all that sort of stuff.
Hey, it's funny you said hardening, and I thought you were going to say something else, and I don't mean your penis. I don't. No, actually, honestly, I thought you were going to talk about hardening of spirit, hardening of one's psyche in both good and bad ways, right? Because, you know, when I think back on my parents getting divorced, I was 5. I have very vague memories of it, and I certainly don't recall any trauma, right? I wasn't conscious of this thing being calamity, you know? And I don't know exactly what it did to me. But I do, I have noticed, it seems this is a gross generalization based on nothing but anecdote, people. So I'm going to offend at least half the audience, that people who have similar situations, similar childhoods in which their parents were divorced at an early age, like you and me, there's just something different about us. And there's like I'd say one thing I've noticed is like we're less comfortable in our skin, or which could be, and when I say skin, that doesn't necessarily mean our body, but our immediate environment. But I don't know. I just feel like there's an edge, like a knife's edge, meaning, you know, harden. When you said harden, that's what came to mind for us. And I think that serves, it's both for me at least, and I think for my son, who also is one of us, because we were divorced. I divorced his mother when he was 7, just like you. There is I don't know, there's an edge, there's a difference, there's a critical take on the world. We're less comfortable, so we're sort of always, we're outside. I think that's it. I think we become liminal, actually.
Yeah. Well, right? Yes, because
unlike the other kids.
Yeah, you're
in between. We're in between, liminal.
Yeah, well, literally back and forth between two worlds, right? Like you said, but also noticing the difference between your mother and your father, which you probably don't for a good while longer if they stay together. Mm-hmm. They probably seem as one to you in a sense that they don't. I mean, even if you were to see them naked, you might notice the difference when you're a kid, but not really. You just don't internalize those things in the same way. So I'm even bodily, they seem sort of like one person at a certain point, you know, passed back and forth between their arms, you know, and then as you, but experiencing them as a split thing, you know, but then also, you know, there's that cool shit that was like, oh my God, 2 Christmases, you know, like that was like,
not for me.
That was like the best, you know, I was like, fuck, I get 2 Christmases, I get 2 birthdays, you know, and, that was all awesome.
That's a question I was going to ask you that I didn't never covered. Your dad was a Christian.
No.
Oh, he wasn't. Okay.
No, my parents were, I was raised a-religiously. So, my mom was raised by Christian fundamentalists.
Oh my God.
Gideons, the people that put the little Bibles in the, and my dad was raised sort of Christian, but it's sort of a mix of Christian and nomadic. I would say gypsy, but that's not the right word. And I realize that can be used as a slur, but people, something about that word real quickly is people who are not white will sometimes use the word gypsy to refer to a whole group of people. And it's not really a slur. It's just that there's no real word for it in translation. Mm-hmm. So sort of Christian, but like nomadic supernatural beliefs. And so there was no real equivalent. There was a church, you know, nearby that had a lot of Arabic language stuff going on in it, but, was raised nothing, not atheistically, not a religious.
So your mom left the church and was rejected the whole thing, or?
Yeah. She discovered Bertrand Russell. And,
you know, she went all the way.
Yeah. Well, she
God,
wasn't
that's
a,
just like my father, Bertrand Russell. We had a poster of Bertrand Russell in our house.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting. She wasn't an atheist though, you know, which he certainly would have probably encouraged in people. She just sort of thought that the critiques were enough to disabuse her of being into the kind of Christianity that her parents were into. You know, I don't think she really held anything against Christianity so much as her parents. She mm-hmm. was able to make that distinction, which a lot of people are not.
Mm-hmm. right.
and that she wasn't like obsessed with Bertrand Russell, you know, which I think is good, cause I'm not a fan really, but she was into him enough that his books were around the house,
right.
And
yeah.
you know,
she's at least a skeptic.
Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly.
A vigorous skeptic.
Right? Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other question that I didn't cover, and that I got to get back to this, what was the roar in the backyard?
Well, that was the devil.
Oh, uh-huh.
But I told you that would be the problematic part for you.
Why'd you say it? You were afraid of me? You were afraid to say it to me?
No, I figured it was assumed.
It.
Yeah. I figured it was,
I didn't hear it.
Well, I didn't tell you. I just figured it was assumed.
Oh, no. No, I come, no. Mm-mm. So,
yeah, but see, I knew that part would be problematic for
yeah,
you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I know. So, okay. let's get this on the table too.
So yes, there's all this, I have all this like occult interest, right? And I have, you know, for most of my life, and that's becoming a much bigger part of my work. Recently, I mean, it's always been really important to me privately, but it's becoming more and more sort of a part of my sort of public space.
You teach courses on it.
I do. Yeah.
So I've been thinking about what to say to you about that for the last week. And here's what I want to say to you about that subject. Okay. I am 100% ignorant mm-hmm. about it and prejudiced against it.
Yes.
So, but at least I'm aware of my prejudice and I pride myself on being open. Also, by the way, I am now very publicly a social constructionist, so which means in part that I believe that any religion, any spiritual belief is just as real as molecular biology, right?
Sure.
So, do you want to do the occult thing now?
Or let's do it. We have the bridge.
Right. No, right. Okay, thank you. Yeah.
Right? That we was might pretty as well. Good. Yeah.
So let's start here, though. When you were, you were eight when that happened?
Something like that. Okay. 7, 8. Yeah.
So how did you conceive of that then, at that moment?
I thought it was the devil.
Oh, you did?
Oh, yeah. But I didn't know what that meant exactly. I have a better idea of what that could mean.
Oh, because
now.
You had seen the, what was it? Your brother's
Dungeons and Dragons book. And I had just said the name, which I am still loath to say.
This Dungeons one
particular,
and Dragons?
No, this oh, one the, particular oh, the name of the devil, of it. Yeah. Yes. So, I don't think I'm going to say it.
What does it begin with?
I'm not going to say it. But it's not that I've said it too. I just, it's like.
So first of all, I got to say this. Yeah. I swear to God, if I were an Arab American porn star,
yeah.
you would not be able to tell us apart. Because my brother,
uh-huh.
guess what he did? He played Dungeons and
D&D.
Dragons.
Yeah.
This is unbelievable. Okay. Did it begin with a C?
No.
Oh, okay. Then I don't know. Then I have no idea.
C.
I didn't really do D&D.
Oh, I see.
I like toyed with it for a minute and I was like, this is not for me.
Uh-huh.
But I want to talk about that too. But
okay.
Anyway.
Yeah. Well, we should talk
so
about
it. So you played
Dungeons
it?
Dragons. Yeah. With my brother. But my brother's 13 years older than me. So it was sort of across a gap. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like it was the way for us to hang out.
You weren't like in a community of D&D
players. No. Yeah, and you know what?
That's
I mean,
what
that
my brother does.
That didn't even really, did that even really exist then? I mean, it was so new. I mean,
that's
you
what it
did.
Always was.
Yeah, but it had just a, it's not like you went, like there was no space like where you went to like the comic book store in the back room and played with like 20 people. You know what I mean? It's not, it's a different thing now, you know, the way
it's
it arranges.
It's a fascinating subculture though, isn't it?
I think it's so fascinating,
and I think
actually.
I've always been, you know, I've always known about it because of my brother. And
yeah.
he's been all in his entire life. I mean, since he was 7.
Yeah.
Till now. He's now 49, and I think he still does it on a regular basis. And he's part of the whole elaborate community, and that's what they talk about. And his way of interacting with the rest of the world is often through that. So he'll make references. But it's also interesting how like there's particular things that subculture is attracted to, and it's so consistent over time and place. So that like when my brother travels to another state, he'll find someone, and they'll immediately... who's of that world, and they'll immediately have 10 things to talk about. And it's like Star Trek, some forms of martial arts, every science fiction movie and book ever, in all the role playing games.
Yeah,
and, like, they can talk huh? and oh, and Buffy the Vampire Slayer. For
well,
some
that
reason.
that's the greatest story ever told. But yeah, Joss Whedon.
Yeah, so they all can talk forever and ever about those subjects, and it's so odd. It's like some kid in Seattle can talk to a kid in Miami, you know, instantly. They have this whole, and like, how does that subculture crosses time and space like that? It's so, and it's so consistent.
You know, I think is so cool too, is the way that we sort of look in at D&D and like how people sort of like get lost in it. And remember all the like fears in the '80s about the satanic panic, like people are going to get like possessed by playing Dungeons and Dragons, yeah. which apparently,
I mean, in Berkeley, apparently we're not too worried about that.
Did happen yeah. in my life.
Right.
But I feel like that's how people look in, people who don't understand postmodern philosophy look at postmodern philosophers like they're all playing Dungeons and Dragons and just creating these terms and mm-hmm. and this yeah. sort of like fantasy world in which they're mm-hmm. like too absorbed in to see outside of. And in fact, that is how it runs in academia a lot. But the people that mm-hmm. are really like the big thinker, they're not like that.
Totally.
They're actually brilliant people.
And well, I think what you want to say, is that that they are doing things that actually have an effect, that really have a real meaning in what the rest of the world consider to be the real world, right?
Right.
So the postmodern ideas actually can and have shaped the way 100%. The so-called real world operates.
Yes.
That's my point. In fact, what I say to my students yeah. is it's actually a matter of life and death.
Mm-hmm.
And I really mean that. So if you make claims that are rooted in nature, if you make essentialist claims, claims that this behavior, that attitude, this way of being are determined by nature, are essential in the nature of something, mm-hmm. right? They can't be, you can't change them, right? There's nothing you can do about it because they come from nature. Then we gotta erect social structures
right.
to deal with that. We can't, you know, there's not, so one of the, here's a few examples, right? The most classic examples, of course, are Black people are intellectually inferior and capable only of manual labor, well, and therefore, A, they have to be taken care of, and B, they should probably be enslaved,
mm-hmm.
okay? Classic, women. They are naturally determined to be mothers and wives, and so we gotta make sure that they stay there. And if they venture out of the home, then we're gonna let them know that, at the very least, they're being unnatural.
Mm-hmm.
So there's shame, and on top of that, we're gonna erect policies that keep them in the home, right? By keeping them out of professions, by keeping them out of the public sphere. Muslims, Arabs, you know, it's like, well, this is a thing. It's just part of who they are. Mm-hmm. There's nothing we can do about it, right? So they're going to continue to try to fly planes into our buildings because that's just who they are in their essence. Mm-hmm. It's all, that gets all muddied because they confuse, you know, ideology, which is a religion, and race.
But Muslims uniquely confuse those two things for some reason.
But there
that's
is
what
sort
people
of a funny
that's
thing.
What people say.
But in a sense, they do actually racialize
yes,
that religion because their yeah. claim is that there's nothing you can do about it, right? Like
right.
like the belief that Black people can do nothing about the fact, the scientific fact that right. they're dumber than we are,
yeah.
right? So that has resulted in, what has it resulted in? It's resulted in people saying, well, there's nothing we can do about those people. They're going to continue to fly planes into our buildings, so we got to kill them because
right.
that's the only way to deal with them. There's
right.
there's no policy change. There's no idea change and nothing else we can do. We got to kill them. They're like psychopaths, right?
Yes. And that's where you divide modernist ideas and postmodernist ideas. Those are modern.
Yeah.
That's why it's called postmodern. That whole way of thinking is what we refer to as the modern, as like the modernist like idea
right.
is there are these essential claims, these things that are essentially true. The British Empire is better than everybody
mm-hmm.
else.
Exactly.
So, you know,
it's also moral. They're moral claims.
Yes, right. Exactly.
Well, that's my favorite, right? Which is when people go moral on it, when they make essentialist moral claims.
Yes.
Right. That Western democracy is just naturally better.
Right. Right. And
there's
so,
nothing you can do about it. It's just a fact. How about this? See, I'm really struck by the idea that you had an experience with the devil
yeah.
when you were 7 years old.
Yeah.
And you're now the devil. You became
yeah.
the devil.
Yes.
But
I did.
And then the immediate, for me, the contradiction that immediately comes up is that you cried when you first encountered the devil.
Mm-hmm.
You were scared of him,
mm-hmm.
but then you became the devil. You did. You became, you know, certainly in this culture, one of the worst things you can become
mm-hmm.
in multiple ways, right? You pretty much hit the trifecta or whatever.
Sodomite, occultist, smart person, Arab. I mean, it's just all over the horrible place.
And queer. And whore.
Yeah.
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 Right.
Awful.
Right. And oh, and intellectual.
The worst. The worst of all.
Damn near perfect. And you live in Hollywood too. So no, I just find that fascinating, right? It, you know what I mean?
Like,
yeah. It's because I've been called that. I mean, I resonate. That resonates with me. Like, I am always simultaneously attracted to being the devil in a sense.
Yeah.
Like calling people out and calling things out and just being kind of cutting against the grain all the time. Like I there's something about me that needs to do that. I can't just let things go that I can't let anything go. Like everything goes through this very fine mesh sieve, uh-huh. right? Which I understand can be annoying or enraging for other people. I get that. So I try to rein it in. I try to be careful with it. But I don't know where it comes from, but it's a devilish thing, right? Because you are the opposite. You're the antagonist. You're the eternal antagonist to the world.
It's one of those things
but,
where,
sorry. Yeah. Oh, and then no, I was just going to say, no, go so ahead. That's, so I am, but I'm all also always feeling bad about it and feeling scared about it and feeling shame about it. And, you know, like in the last week, so since the Rogan thing, I've been called a faggot, a cunt, a pussy, and then that's easy. But the stuff that actually gets me, which is, again, said by people that I don't really respect, but it still gets me, is like, you're the stupidest person on the earth, and you don't know anything about science, and you don't know anything about the real world, and
yeah.
you're the dumbest person, and right, and you're an asshole, and you're a smug, you name it, superior, you know, intellectual, blah, blah, blah. You'd look down on us, all that. And, but I actually worry about that stuff. I can't just brush it off. Even though it comes from cavemen.
Yeah.
Right. I don't, yeah. It bugs me. So I'm like, and I feel like maybe, I don't know if that's true for you or not, but like,
yeah.
I'm ambivalent always about this position I find myself in all the time that I put myself into.
I just want to make a declarative statement right okay. now.
Yeah.
Scientists and science minded people who are not into postmodern ideas are not scientists. They're charlatans. They're fakes. So quite the opposite that everybody's saying. Because here's the thing. So when people are like, you don't understand science, you don't want... No. Those people don't understand science. Because science, at its heart, is interested and invested in these questions. And real scientists, and I've been around them because I studied science for 3 years in grad school. I did my due diligence with it. they care about this shit. Real scientists say there's no such thing as objective reality.
There you go. Yeah.
They're interested in that question.
There you go.
And they could be quantum physicists. They could be biologists. There's this big divide between physics and biology, which is stupid. But people who, and largely a lot of these people who are making these scientific truth claims are biologists, often phony biologists like Richard Dawkins, who is a zoologist who therefore knows very little about most of biology because it's most living things are bacteria. He doesn't know almost anything about that world and creates an entire version of evolution that excludes the most prevalent types of organisms on the planet. So we'll get back
well,
to that.
Well, I was just going to say, yeah, sorry. But I mean, I think that's such an important point.
Okay.
And I love that, what you just said. So I know nothing at all about zoology,
yeah.
you know, biology, you name it. I'm a total ignoramus about most fields of science. And people are like, see, that proves that you're wrong about what you were saying about yeah. objective reality. No, anyone who says the science is settled,
yeah.
I think you're right, Connor. Like that is not a scientist because yeah. that means science stops.
Totally.
There's no need for science. When people say that climate change is a settled question, mm-hmm. then I ask, then why do you want federal funding for more climate change
research? Right?
Research. Hello. Of course not. Ask any serious climate change scientist, no matter what their position is on it, they'll say, oh my God, there are nothing but new questions.
Right.
You know, and they're constantly revising it. And so anyone who wants to look into this further, the first text to start with, I think, is Thomas Kuhn. Mm-hmm. Thomas Kuhn, The Structures of Scientific Revolutions,
yeah.
right, which I read in college and blew my mind away. Although I didn't quite get it then, I really got it later. And all he does is he just looks at the history of scientific claims. Mm-hmm. So, you know, one minute the sun revolves around the earth, and then the next minute the earth revolves around the sun. One minute the earth is flat, the next minute it's a
right.
perfect sphere. Oh, and now it's sort of oblong, and that's changing. Gravity. People are always like, well, what, gravity doesn't exist then? And I say, well, you know what? As a matter of fact, just I think just last year or something, these astrophysicists saw that gravity's working in a different way in certain other constellations or something that they, the theory of gravity predicts. So yeah, but you're right. I mean, to me, like, that's what makes a scientist. That's the starting point. And it's that there is nothing settled. Nothing ever can be settled. All you do is continue to ask questions and explore things.
And for all his bombastic craziness that I don't agree with sometimes, I have this sort of love hate with this guy, Massimo. I always pronounce his name wrong, but Massimo Puglucci or whatever. And he writes about distinguishing bunk from real science, right? He's kind of a debunker skeptic kind of guy.
Right.
He irritates the fuck out of me sometimes. But something that he says, which I think is really valuable, and I think people who are skeptical of science should actually take this to heart, is that you don't necessarily have a right to argue with the consensus as a non-scientist. There are such things as consensuses within the sciences. So it doesn't matter. So in one sense, we should put aside, just for a second, the idea that science is never settled. There is consensus between scientists that is valuable for certain projects.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let me sort of take it away from him and add the thing you're saying in. However, that doesn't mean that the discussion doesn't belong to all of us in some way. It doesn't belong to me to go on a public stage and tell people that that climate change isn't happening, right? But we have to understand that there is real debate and real shifting of at least certain details in that whole field that's interesting, that's valuable amongst them. And also that people are, as you said, invested in finding out more. And there are reasons they're invested in finding out more. Mm-hmm. And now it might sound like I contradicted myself because I just said Richard Dawkins's version of evolution is bullshit.
That you're making a truth claim.
Yes. And I'm not a scientist. And right. I just said, oh, well, we don't have but his view actually isn't scientific consensus. So there's also this whole other version of science that we have to sort of take into account, which is that the public face of science and scientific ideas and pop science and science journalism is very often not what scientists are discussing and talking about anymore. So this sort of dumb, outdated idea that random genetic mutation meets natural selection is how evolution works, most biologists don't believe in that anymore. Richard Dawkins is an artifact. And yet, because he has such a public voice as this sort of politically positioned person who has a very specific mission in the public sphere, we accept that that's the scientific explanation. And we have the duty to also ask questions like that and therefore send our minds elsewhere to go do more reading, go do more research, ask more questions, all that kind of stuff. And it reveals to us something new. So I think that we have a whole set of problems ahead of us, and some are scientific, some are political, some are reality claims, some are philosophical claims.
There are many moral panics going on right now, but one of them that I think is especially interesting and understudied is the panic about the so-called crisis of expertise. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's this book out recently by, what's his name, Tom Nichols, called The Death of Expertise. Mm-hmm. And for him, that's a terrible thing. And for me,
it's
cause for celebration.
Yeah.
You know, and again, this is why I'm a historian, because all you got to do is look at the history of this question. And that is, it's about a 150-year-old thing, expertise. It's lasted about 150 years, right? And it was invented in the late 19th century when the church was pushed out in Europe and America as sort of the source of authority on things, and it was replaced by scientists in terms of the physical world and, you know, and even psychology and even sexuality and all these things, right? So-called scientists move in. Medical doctors, psychologists, biologists, sociologists. So scientists, broadly speaking. And they established their own associations, their own institutions. Each one of them has its own. There's the American Sociological Association. There's the American Psychological Association. There's the American Historians Association. You name it, right? And they set rules as to who gets to be included. And then there's institutions called universities where they get employed. And they have the same rules. So they're all in league together. And they say, if you have this idea, you don't get a card to our club. And you don't get to be an expert. We're the experts. Mm. We're the ones. We went to Harvard or Yale, and we're a member of the ASA, and we know what's true, or at least, you know, close enough. So it's been a monopoly, And by the way, they've gotten government support in doing this as well, because the federal government has propped up these universities and colleges and been working with these professional associations all along. And the thing they've been saying is, you know, if you're a normal person without the particular credentials, without the particular education, and even without the particular ideas, you're not an expert, and you don't get to, no one should listen to you. And by the way, and then so the media has always been a major part of that until recently, right? So the New York Times, I was just saying this to someone, just until about 5 years ago, if the New York Times didn't write a glowing review of your book, you did not have a career as an author, basically, unless you did like romance fiction or something. So these gatekeepers were there, which were in league with those associations. Do you think the New York Times ever asked someone outside of the American Sociological Association to review a book on sociology? Mm. No, of course not. Same with science. It's one big monopoly, has been. Now, they're right to panic, because right now, all that stuff is, in fact, it's being eroded. I was going to say under assault. That's not really true. It's sort of just eroding. People are just moving away from it. And Trump is just one actually small example of that, right? So the internet, blogs, podcasts has changed the whole media landscape. So we're doing this right now, and thousands of people are going to listen to this, no matter what the New York Times thinks, no matter what the American Historical Association thinks, right? And science is changing too. People have access to scientific information. People have access to research now. Click of a button, you can read pretty much anything you want. And they're starting to ask questions. The plebs, you know, the non-experts. Well, I can understand why the so-called experts are absolutely freaking out, and why they want to get Hillary Clinton back in office to set things right, you know, right? Because that's where they come from.
This principle, there's a principle, basic psychoanalysis principle, that there's a tension between experts and enjoyment, and like people who are just like enjoyable and fun, okay? I'm just talking about it in plain terms. Like, either you get brainy Smurf who's like, well, actually, this and such and such and such and such is true, and they're like, they seek their authority through telling you what is actually true. Or you get the people that are really just sort of fun to hang out with, and like, you know, they enjoy life, they're gonna throw a good party, who gives a fuck what they think? Like, you're having, you know, there's a tension between those two things. I'm making a very simple, you know, concept, but it's like we're starting we're starting to really rebel against brainy Smurf, right? As you point out, the expert, the person that has authority by knowing facts, knowing information, and we're seeing the erosion of that in so many ways, whether it's fake news or whatever. One way we're seeing it is, well, Trump became president because we thought we are excited about a narrative about making America great again. We're excited about a narrative of the sort of freedom of express your religion, express your whatever, in whatever way you want. Like, this is what Trump's promising, you know. On another way we're seeing it is this sort of something that comes up when you talk a lot, is this social justice warrior thing on campus, where you're starting to see how irrelevant universities are becoming by the kinds of conflicts that are happening on them that are being so led by the students. And one thing that people don't talk about in those conflicts at all is that the students are saying, we're going to be the ones that determine our fate and our destiny in this system now. Mm-hmm. We're going to be saying, because guess what? Your expertise about like the sort of, you know, like 19th century women writers who had syphilis and lint in their hair is not valuable to us anymore. What we want is to be the ones that guide this based on our experience and what makes us feel good and what makes us feel bad. So they're two sides of the same coin. And of course, then like the battles become these really pedantic things because they're really about comfort. They're about what feels good. But at the base of that, I think, is another version of people deciding that experts are irrelevant, and also sensing that the kind of education they're getting from experts is now irrelevant. You might have people that are really great in universities. There are still plenty of people who are amazing professors in universities. they're so few and far between, though. they always kind of were, but the information that came from the shitty ones wasn't available. Right. Now that it is,
right.
It's really exposed how useless they are. And as you've pointed out many times, the hiring committees are people wanting people like themselves, because no one wants to be, if they're not worth anything, set in stark contrast to someone, you know? I mean, that happens at lots of jobs. Like, you go in and you present your best face, and then, you know, like, once you get in, like, you become, you reveal yourself to be different. That's what people who are good professors do. They go in for the interview and they're like, yeah, sure, I like these ideas that everybody's talking about right now. And then they get in and they're like, all right, actually, no, like, fuck you, I have these. But you have to do that to be a good professor. You have to lie at first.
Absolutely.
You know?
Right. To get tenure, certainly.
Yeah. So I think there are all these versions of it, and it's actually located in places where you might not at first identify that this impetus to overthrow the experts. Those experts should be gone. The way that we decide to overthrow the experts and what that decision and the actions we take does to us as people is really important, because the ways that we're doing it, I think, are really damaging to us. I think the ways that we're dealing with these kinds of politics on campuses, the way that we're, I'm just talking about collectively as a culture, the way that we're sort of deifying either Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders or whatever, I think that these things are extremely damaging. Mm-hmm. However, the impulse seems very similar to
me. So you just made me rethink my whole thing about campus politics and what's going on there. Or maybe put together different ideas that I've been having, but no, it's a reformulation. So it's great. So I love what you said about how students, in a sense, what's going on campuses is that they're rebelling against the experts, mm-hmm. right? That they're rebelling against the authority figures there, professors, I suppose, and maybe the administrators. I think that's true to some extent. Now, of course, there are many professors who are basically ringleading all mm-hmm. this stuff, right? I mean, and their fault. So basically, it's sort of, there's the good professors, there's the virtuous, justice-oriented professors who get the kids
right.
their information and their language, right, and their anger in some ways, or they direct their anger. And then there's the bad professors, the ones who are supposedly racist or sexist or whatever, you know, homophobic, you name it. And then it kind of, that's the fight on the campus. But it is a rebellion. The difference is that, and you're right about this, that, you know, until about 20 to 30 years ago, until the 1960s, there was no rebellion at all on college campuses, right? Mm-hmm. Because there was just this deference to authority. Mm-hmm. That's what you were supposed to do. There was not even a question. Oh my God, of course these people know it's right. So you just follow
them. You
may
not even ask questions in class.
But it's still true, though, yeah. to a large extent, you know, that certainly most of my students just assume that I'm right about stuff. It's kind of amazing, right? Because I'm a professor and I have a PhD or whatever, or I'm just in this classroom and I'm standing in front of them and they just assume that I'm right. Not all, but I think generally speaking, that's probably true. But I think that there is a change now, because you do see them, students at least, more willing than ever to not just question authority, but rebel openly against it. Now, in 99% of the cases, I don't side with them on what they're rebelling about. Mm-hmm. I don't want to go where they want to take us. But here's the thing. I have always taken the position that students should be treated like consumers, in that they should, what you said, they should choose what they learn. They should choose what they study. They should choose what classes are on offer. They should choose who their teachers are, right? Radical concept. Ask a professor what they think about that, they'll freak out. This is the worst thing you can propose to them. Mm. They know that they know what students should learn. They're sure of that. And they're very sure that students don't know what mm-hmm. they should learn, right? So they treat them like children. Well, it's openly paternalistic system.
Totally.
Right. And so when I say consumers, that's all I mean. I don't mean that we should make Harvard into McDonald's. I'm just saying that why is it different than all other businesses and industries? Think about it, right? Where the consumer, because that's what they are, they're paying these people to give them services. It's the only industry in which the customer is not allowed to make choices.
Because it's an extension of the obedience industry of public schooling in our culture, right? I mean, it's like, that's the model that we continue to use, and that public school model is sick.
I love what you said about your first memory, your the first thing you remember about your public school experience was, what was it?
Oh, that I realized that in our previous conversation, we talked about this, that I had a moment where I realized that I had to raise my hand to ask a question or go to the bathroom. And that makes you quite disliked by the people in power, because you just have this thought, what?
Yeah.
And suddenly everything just sort of pops out into this new sort of version of things. Yeah. And why? You know, I don't get it. And then you really start seeing this sort of tightly wound system of obedience. And I almost failed out of, you know, high school. There's one reason why I didn't. And it was because of my, as far as I know, this is what was explained to me, because of my IQ, they weren't allowed to ever hold me back.
Oh, really?
So there was a system, after you're tested for your IQ, you're placed in gifted, a sort of gifted category.
Do you know what your IQ is? I don't okay. know what mine is. I've never been told.
I might, but I don't even like saying it, because I
have
my
own. You don't have to say the number, but do you know what it is? Yeah. Or have you been told a number?
I was told when I was younger.
Yeah.
It might not be
I've
that
never
anymore.
Been told.
Yeah.
It's one of the reasons I'm so skeptical of IQ generally.
Yeah.
And I just, because I don't care, because, you know, I'm in the position now where it just really doesn't matter. I mean, if you told me it was 80, I would be fine. Like, it wouldn't bother me at all.
Right.
If you told me it was 180, I would be like, that's bullshit.
Yeah, it measures something, right? But
yeah,
what is it?
Sure.
But I think that what you're talking about, I have a question about this, about students choosing. Now, it's not because I take the side of the professors who absolutely know. However, I wonder if we let people choose, because of the context of our culture that we have right now, they'll just choose to become experts. So in other words, like, I'm going to sort of filter, like, this is the thing I've always sort of love about what is supposed to be a liberal arts education, is like, we're going to give you lots of stuff, right? And that, because of the way culture operates right now, and because of the intense encouragement to expertise, that people will just choose this like path. And I don't have a problem with that necessarily, or, I mean, if people want to do that, go ahead and fucking do it. However, I wonder if that's a conflict in what you're saying,
that they will then become experts.
Yeah.
Self-described, designated experts.
Yeah.
What you mean? Well, sure. So what though? I mean, if you don't have to believe them, you don't have to follow what they say.
I see. But I'm just talking about, we're going to at least,
I mean, the world
transition.
Is already full of those people,
right?
Everybody's a self-designated expert on something
or
many things, right? It's like, we sift that out and we choose who we want to believe. No, it's remarkable. So here's the thing. I have thrown that idea out there about students as consumers, treating them as such. And so far, everyone disagrees with me. Everyone. Here's the thing. Social justice warrior type professors totally disagree with me, of course, because then the bad ideas come in, you know, if you let the students choose. Conservatives disagree with me. Well, think about it, right? The modern, so-called modern university is modeled after medieval institutions, right? Where priests taught, the church taught. The church was the sovereign in those universities, those seminaries, right? Libertarians have disagreed with me on this. I couldn't believe that. I said, are you kidding me? You guys are about consumer choice in everything else, but not this? Because their problem is, they think if you let the students decide what ideas they will learn, the social justice ideas, the socialist ideas, the bad ideas. Same as the conservatives. They all have this anxiety.
They're all threatened.
They
by
all
freedom.
Yep. They all. Yep. Isn't that funny? They all
threatened
have this
my freedom.
They all have this anxiety.
Sound like George Bush for a second.
Yep. About letting kids study what they want to study. Jeez, man.
Yeah, there are some positions that are just universally unpopular. Like, I don't know if I believe this or not, but I sometimes just say that I don't believe that schools should be funded by the government, like public schooling should be funded by the government. And people get really, like, I think universally people fucking hate that idea.
Wait,
you know?
You think it should not be funded?
I'm not tied to the idea. It's just something I throw out every once in a while to see.
Defunded immediately.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay,
so, God, you're preaching to the choir.
Okay. Okay. Good. Okay. Good. Well, see, okay. Then I'm wrong. I thought that everybody
I hate
just
public
hated that.
Oh, no. I mean, it's a libertarian position.
So is it?
Oh, yeah. Sure. Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
Totally.
All right.
Yeah.
So so the idea for libertarians is that it should be funded by corporations or just not at all?
Just leave it
just
alone.
Just whatever you do.
Just get the government out.
Yeah, I see.
And then whoever fills, you know, whoever takes over can take over. But,
got it.
You know, and it's not even about, no one can take over. That's the thing, right?
Yeah.
Because sure, there will be private companies that do it, and there'll be McDonald's might have a school, but there'll be, you know, a billion Christian schools and a billion socialist, you know, little schools, and then everything will be, it'll be, all the flowers will bloom, right?
Right.
At least that's the theory. But the main, the position is just get the government out.
I see.
And I am 100% clear on that. Having been through public school for 13 years, having seen my son go through public school for now it's 11 years, hating every minute for me, hating every minute for him, and he's with me on this. So it's just that we have no choice because the government has a monopoly, and we can't afford to spend $50,000 a year at Crossroads in Santa Monica, where the celebrities' kids go,
right,
the private school. So it's, you know,
That's good. So I was ignorant of the libertarian position. But I was just trying to say there are some positions like the one that you just brought up about people directing their own education that just seem to be universally
in the town
hated.
You live in.
Yeah.
You know? Oh yeah. I'm sure you will have a hard time finding it's a minority position for sure.
Yeah.
You know, and in liberal Los Angeles, it's a weird thing. It's a bad thing. It's actually you're a mean person. You lack compassion because of course the poor will then be uneducated.
Yeah.
Because they're so well educated now in those public schools.
Right. And also the rich are so educated into like great value systems
that
lead
great.
Them to treat fantastic. Others so well. Yeah.
So fantastic. Yeah. I mean, just really please go to Compton High School, everyone right now, and see how it's going down there.
Uh-huh.
What is actually going on at Compton High School?
Well, I mean, go to Catasauqua High School though, dude. It's like,
it's a prison.
Where I grew up, even though it wasn't wealthy, but it was well to do enough. It was middle class enough. I had a teacher kick me in the stomach in the middle of class.
Oh, yeah.
I had a teacher tell me she was going to send me back to Syria on a camel if I didn't shut up. I had kids bullying me. It was for certain people in those systems, it's also just total hell unless you decide to go along with the fucking brutalist, I like brutalist architecture, so brutal bullshit. Just like sort of current of those kinds of places.
Yeah.
Now, of course, there are always people in those systems, in university systems, in public schooling systems that are awesome. There's always like the English teacher or the music teacher or whatever. That's great. So it's like people get all upset like, oh, you're shitting on teachers. It's like, no. But like the ones that are good are the exception, you know?
Yeah, so, it's funny, you know, when I go through TSA, which I have to do every week now, I have a, you know, grudge against TSA generally. But I sort of think, should I hate all the agents? You know, no, and I don't. I mean, I don't know what to think about the genuinely sort of nice people who treat me well, who are TSA agents who hassle me and make me miss my flight, which just happened actually yesterday. But, you know, but then there's the guys who are have the little bit of power and love using it and love being, you know, being sort of the superior to you in that moment. But, you know, I guess I just would think about them the way I would think of prison guards.
Oh.
Are those evil people? I mean, I don't even think cops are evil. I don't think anyone's evil, of course, since I'm a postmodernist. I don't think there's such a thing as evil. They're human beings, you know, and they're just constructs and whatever. But I don't, you know, I guess I'm a little at least annoyed with them because these are educated people who should know better. Here's the thing, guys. Look, if I don't send my son to a school, I go to prison. Okay. No one even ever, that never occurs to
it's
people.
Crazy.
That's actually it's compulsory, right?
Yeah.
I go to prison if I don't send him to a school. I can send him to a private school, but of course I can't afford a private school. So therefore, poor people, all poor people pretty much, most of them at least, have to send their kids to these public schools. Okay.
Sure.
Or they go to prison. Okay. That's the deal. It's at a point of a gun. No shit. Now,
so public education is in essence a vaccination.
Can the children leave the school during the day? No. No, they cannot. They have to stay there from 7 a.m. or whatever to 8 a.m. to 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. every day. Mm. If they do leave the school, what will happen to them if the police catch them? They will catch them, arrest them, put them in their car, and take them back to the school. If they do it twice or three times or five times, we have places for those kids too. It's called juvenile detention centers, which are jails, right? So they go to prison too, right? So it's completely compulsory. It is enforced literally at the point of a gun because the cops who come to arrest you have guns, right? So then where does that leave us as to who the teachers are?
Right.
Right. Sure sounds like a day prison to me, like a day camp, day prison. But it's you have to go. And there's guards there. They're the ones who report on you if you leave the class.
And you have to perform while you're there too.
Sure.
So you're not allowed any really big range of behaviors while you're in that place. You have to sit in a chair and be quiet. You have to absorb the information. I mean, Clockwork Orange style, keep your eyes open, take everything in that's being like sent to you. Mm-hmm. And you have to prove that you took the information in. So it's all this sort of like, and I mean, I think it's really that whole system of obedience that carries over into universities, that carries over into the workforce. I mean, it's just from as soon as you can think, really, you're thrown into it. Mm-hmm. And we should be really questioning that to begin with.
So you know what happened when you were 5 years old in kindergarten?
Yeah.
You did. That's exactly what you did. And so the question you asked in your own mind, I suppose, you may not have articulated it outside, but outside yourself, was, you know, why do I have to raise my hand to go to the bathroom? Mm-hmm. Why do I have to raise my hand? Why do I have to get permission to speak? Mm-hmm. Right? That is actually a monkey wrench in the whole system.
Yep.
Right? Because so far, you know, there have been very, very few kids like you, right, who at least would continue to ask that question. Mm-hmm. It's been a bunch of kids who asked that question on the first day of kindergarten, mm-hmm. right? But they get broken like horses,
right?
Right? We put them in the pen and we don't let them leave. And if the horse tries to jump out of the pen, we whip it until it goes back into the pen.
Right.
So most kids learn quickly. they get contained. Those questions get contained or repressed, and then they're okay. But you didn't. You kept asking that question. You kept having that question. At least you kept feeling that question, seems to me.
It's a question that
you continue to
now.
Be the devil
yeah.
in that system.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a question that stays with me now. It's the question that, like I said, punk rock allowed me to ask. It allowed me to be the person that was asking that question. I mean, the essential sort of line of punk rock, the base of it, and this is why it's not enough, but the base of it is fuck you, I won't do what you
exactly.
tell me, right?
I love how you said it's not enough.
Yes.
That's my position on punk rock. Yeah.
Well, I mean, just resistance is not enough.
Exactly.
Resistance is, I mean, well, just give you the sense that your identity comes from the thing that you're resisting, and therefore you always need it.
Ooh.
And therefore you can never let it go.
Massive, huge move right there. Yeah. I love that. Love that. Did you hear what he just said? See, that's the thing. When you identify yourself as a victim, well, you kind of did it a little bit differently, but that's essentially the same argument, right? It's like then, and you're appealing to the oppressor,
right?
To change things for the better for you. That means you are dependent on the oppressor.
It's like today when
for your identity
today or two days ago or whatever, Stephen Colbert, I don't know when this is going to come out, but Stephen Colbert made a joke about, he went a long rant against Donald Trump and said one thing in there about like how Trump was Putin's cock holster or something like that. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, the whole Russia thing is fucking stupid.
The queering of Trump has been really interesting, right?
Right.
The whole making him Putin's bitch, et cetera.
It has its own sort of thing. But, and I'm not, the whole Russian thing I think is boring and stupid, but the thing that's interesting to me about it and why I'm bringing it up is all these gay people lost their shit about. They were like, this is homophobic. I can't believe you made that homophobic joke.
No.
And for me, it's just like, how invested are you in your own identity that this person who, by the way, years ago ridiculed the biggest war criminal in the world, George W. Bush, to his face for an hour, looked in, was standing right there and just fucking made fun of him. You can watch the video. It's amazing.
You're talking about Colbert?
Yes. Yeah. And is now with the huge audience, like really just in a national site, like taking the president apart. That, by the way, has this whole cabinet of anti-LGBT people mm-hmm. like surrounding him. Mm-hmm. And he says something using a centuries-old tactic, which is using sexual imagery to humanize people in power and therefore remove their power. And the thing that they picked out was, oh, this is homophobic.
Oh, you're actually defending the queering of Trump in this case.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
I mean, to me, in the context of the whole thing, I just thought...
I mean, I certainly wasn't offended by it. I just thought it was interesting that people used that tactic. Right?
Wasn't a great joke.
No, I just think it's...
It was a bad joke. But it wasn't homophobic in the sense that everybody was saying it was. It's like, look, all these people in the LGBT movement, well, especially, let's just say the G movement, really... worked so hard to make gay quote unquote normal. So it's like, okay, so if someone's evidencing that gay is normal now by just making a sex joke and thinking that gay is like normal enough that now we're just making sex jokes. It could have been, I mean, if there were a female leader or whatever, like that joke might have had a sort of different resonance, but it just seemed to me like gay is normal to Stephen Colbert. So he just says this thing as he's in the process, this long rant of insulting Trump to millions of people being able to view this thing. I mean, it's a pretty bold thing to do. Not that I think Stephen Colbert's some amazing hero or whatever, but it just, it showed me the investment of a certain kind of identity that people had, that even in that context, it was so impermissible because it somehow seemed like a threat to the identity of certain people.
Yeah. Well, so
that was a resistance move that I just, that's a moment where I'm like, resistance is not enough. This is not, this person, Colbert was doing something creative, not just resisting. Mm-hmm. This is something different.
But I mean, I would say that Colbert was doing something that was essentially anti-gay, right? Because he's saying that being a, what is it? Cock holster? What is that?
Yes.
Okay. Being a cock holster is a bad thing. Right. And so to me, the queer move, meaning like queer theorists, queer politics, yeah, is to say, sure, fine, but we don't care. That's fine, or we think it's a good thing, but it's certainly not a negative thing. And I think what you're saying, and this is where I think I agree with you, is that the non-queer gays, right, the mainstream gays, gay ink, whatever you want to call them, right, liberal gays, they're only concerned with the insult. So it becomes, right, what they do is they actually confirm, in a sense, that being gay is bad, because
yes.
Because why else would it hurt you,
right,
to say that gay sex, which he was referring to, basically, right, is bad? I mean, right? That's the only way it would hurt.
But I actually, then the only thing I would add to that, because I agree exactly with what you're saying, I think you explained it better than I do, is that he's making, was that somehow gay sex was, that it was about gay sex in that case? To me, I don't actually think it was. I think it was about sex. I think sex is a bigger container than sexuality. Well, it's sort of a larger thing. And so the focus, it was a bad joke, and so it sort of fell flat. But the idea was, again, there's this really long history, hundreds of years old, stretching at least back to the 16th century, of people using sexual imagery, sexual jokes to make fun of leaders. And it wasn't just gay or straight or whatever. It was just sexual jokes to,
right,
humanize people who seem beyond the pale. And yeah, also notice that a lot of those gay people that were pissed off about that comment were like, yeah, piss tape. We're going to come out with a piss tape that like finally like shows that Trump's like into piss. And there's like a video of hookers pissing on him. Like they didn't care about sexuality then. So in that case, it just becomes this weird, again, this identity resistance politic, which I think is really problematic, yeah, in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Okay. I don't know. I mean, I think there's some, I think they're on both sides, or all sides, they're anti-sex. Actually, I think, by the way, I have an argument that Trump is queer. I do. No, he is. He's also black, by the way. Honestly. No, seriously. Right. I have a whole argument for that, but we can do that another time. No, I mean, he is in that he breaks all those rules, right? He breaks many of the cardinal rules of heteronormativity, being a heteronormative man, actually of respectable masculinity. He breaks all those rules, of being a respectable upper class person in America, right? And he's black in that way too, right? So he's all about gold plated everything. Who does that? Rappers. Rappers do that. And is that good or bad? It's horrible. It shows that they don't know about money. They're not disciplined. They're not responsible, right? They're self-aggrandizing. All these bourgeois virtues, right? They're violating. They're driving a truck through it. Trump does the same thing.
He and his wife are sex workers also.
So, well, yeah, essentially, yeah. So, I mean...
No, I mean, they were both...
Yeah, his wife is a model. It means he cares about sex and not about her virtue, not about her intelligence, not about her, you know, her moral standing. It's just that she's a model. And so that's bad too. Bourgeois culture said, you know, you got to treat people as non-sexual objects. He's like, no, she's sexual. My daughter is hot. You know, it's the worst thing you can say, but he's actually violating all those rules. He treats the world as sex place, you know, sort of like you do.
he doesn't do it.
So like he is like the drag queens and he is like the rappers in that way.
Did you want to ask me a direct question?
Yeah. I want to bring you back. Yeah, totally. Yeah. I want to track back. Totally.
You are?
Yeah.
How the fuck are we going to track back through that?
Watch me.
You got a machete?
What do you, why? Oh, oh, cut through the jungle. Yeah. No. So, you're the devil, man. You're the devil in this public school. I love that. That's my favorite thing in the whole wide world. That's my favorite thing is the 5-year-old kindergartner who asks the question, why am I here? Basically, is really what you were asking, you know? Mm-hmm. Punk rock. I didn't know about that. You didn't talk about that last week. So when did you get into punk rock?
How did I get into punk rock? It's a really good question that I've never had to answer before.
This was 80s, 90s?
90s. I think my sister listened to good music. Late 80s.
Good music. Late 80s. That was a modernist turn you just took there. Good music is the worst thing you can say.
Good music to me. Let's just say that.
Music that you liked.
Are we about to have a Joe Rogan crazy discussion?
Yes.
Where we talk about the word good for an hour?
No, we're not. No,
okay. I think that was it. I think she listened to like sort of cool, weird music and I just sort of latched onto it. God, what did she listen to? I mean, these are sort of starter bands, so they're not what I ended up listening to. She listened to Ween, which was completely bonkers, right? At the first Ween album that had come out at the time, which was just bizarre. She listened to, The Descendants. Mm-hmm. She listened to, what else did she listen to? I mean, the grunge bands before grunge hit, she would listen to like Screaming Trees and these sorts of bands. So it was like I was encountering all that stuff. And then, of course, you know, and she listened to this band called Mary's Danish, which was this California band.
Oh, yeah.
So there's all these like, yeah, alternative bands and sort of punk bands that were precursors to the time that alternative and punk hit. So I was listening to that stuff. And then, of course, Nirvana came out and, you know, that led down its own sort of weird rabbit hole. But then I just would like get these music catalogs and start going to shows and seeing local punk bands and, you know, paying attention to what kind of music they liked, who they were covering, you know, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, getting record label catalogs. It was before the internet. So you had to do all these sort of weird moves. Mm-hmm. But interestingly, I knew way more about music then than I do now.
Right, but what about that particular music was attractive to you?
Oh. You know, before I sort of woke up to the sentiment that there was a fuck you, I won't do what you tell me aspect of that music, right? That'd be a hard question for me to answer. I'm not sure what I liked about it before I understood that that's what it was doing. Mm-hmm. I think maybe I had an intuition or maybe I just liked it cause my sister thought it was cool. You know, my sister was hanging out with skaters that I wanted to fuck me, you know, or something like that.
Oh, so that's interesting.
Yeah.
So here's why I didn't like it. That music, it wasn't sexy. So if you think about
that's funny.
It, right. So to me, there have been in my lifetime since the 1960s, 1970s, there've been two major forms of, you know, alternative, antagonistic, subversive, I suppose, countercultural music, right? Punk rock and hip hop. Mm. Okay. Of course, yes, I know both have gone commercial in various ways and both have not always been antagonistic and countercultural, but you know, that's certainly where they started. And I think that still, they are still fundamentally countercultural. Here's the difference to me. And I was always the white kid who loved black music and I was around punk rockers because it was huge in Berkeley in the 80s when I was a teenager. So I knew it, like the hardcore scene and all that. I just didn't like it because it was like about anger, which is cool. I'm fine with that. But that was it. Like it ended with anger. It was just sort of like bald headed guy, with a leather jacket screaming on a stage about the cops or his parents or you name it. Fine. Great. I get it. It's your thing about resistance. You know, to me, it's sort of just resistance. And often it wasn't even political, which is also fine, but it was sort of this hard, narrow, often mean, often usually very masculine in that way, art form. And it's just, I just have never liked that, but it's not sensual. Right? In fact, it's deliberately anti-sensual. It was a reaction to disco and a reaction to sort of hippie flower music, both of which are quite sensual. One is very sexual and one is very much about like lying in fields with, you know, the maiden and the flowers. Right. I mean, so it was very, and the piercings, the safety pins, the deliberate infliction of pain.
Well, I don't want to get SJW on you, but I think that was because you're a dude that likes women when you're younger.
That's
because
fine,
when you're a guy watching the fucking intense, sweaty, screaming punk rock singer saying fuck you to the world,
mm-hmm.
and you're attracted to men, and you haven't told anybody you're attracted to men, ooh. Nothing could be more sexual.
Oh, awesome.
It was overwhelmingly thank you. Sexual. Yeah. Because it was like...
I missed that. I didn't get that.
The outsiders are screaming and sweating, and they're on stage in camaraderie with each other and all sort of performing together.
Hmm.
To me, so fucking hot.
Hmm.
So hot. And then the men just sort of pushing up against each other in the audience if it was a big show or, you know... Or getting physical with each other, and very there was a lot of touchy camaraderie among the guys too. That yeah. it was so erotic yeah. for me. But I get the version you're saying too. Why wouldn't be? Yeah. It would be anti-sensual.
Yeah. No, yeah. I also agree with you totally. Like when I said it's not sensual, I immediately was thinking, but it's of course erotic
uh-huh.
in many ways. But I can certainly immediately see what you're talking about it being erotic. I mean, to me, everything's erotic, right? Uh-huh. So I mean, sex is sure. everywhere. You and I agree yeah. on that too. It's just that particular kind of eroticism doesn't appeal to me. That's all. But it was that's all. I happened to choose for whatever reason, you know, a particular form of sensuality and eroticism,
right.
you know, as what I liked. And it was sort of, and it was the antithesis, the deliberate antithesis to that stuff. I mean, I was into soul and disco and dance music. Like it was like deliberately anti-dance. And to me, dance is really, really important. Dancing, social dancing. And to me, that's where liberation is. Why are you laughing?
'Cause I once said, sort of riffing off of Emma Goldman, if I can't stand by the bar and not dance to it, it's not my revolution.
Exactly.
Because yeah. I hate dancing.
Yeah. Yeah. Emma's like the one.
And I know that's a misquote of her too. She didn't actually say that.
No, but she, yeah, I mean, she was more problematic, but she's one of the few sort of people on the left that I can be sympathetic to. But
she's awesome.
Yeah, well, she's got some problems. But look at what she said about sex work, by the way. She was not good on sex work.
No, but she did hate marriage, so that was
fun. Yeah, no, she was
like
good on marriage.
She started to even it out in some way.
She sucked on sex work. She was anti sex work. And you're doing sex work because you're forced to by circumstance, was her argument. You know,
I'm forced to by my desires.
Yeah, no, she wouldn't say that. That's exactly what she did not say. So yeah, no, I can totally get that. Yeah. If you're attracted to masculine men, hey, that's the place to be. So then the question arises immediately in my mind, like, all those guys, because it was mostly guys, not entirely, but all those guys who are really into that scene, is that what was going on with them?
I think it was that. I think it was also just a form of spirituality for a lot of people in the sense of, you know, and that is, I would say, it was transcendent beyond resistance, but people just didn't know it. So in the sense of, fuck you, I won't do what you tell me. The question remains, well, what will you do? And the answer was, I'll make music. And to me, that is a creation after the refusal. And to me, that is spiritual. And so I think a lot of people went for those reasons. And it's why also you find spiritual themes running through some punk rock music. But also the punk rock that I was listening to that I eventually got deeper and deeper into was really post-punk music. So I lived, you know, grew up in Pennsylvania. And so it was really this sort of Discord Records scene, and that's who I was inviting to play shows. So this wasn't Discord, but close enough, this band called Chisel, which Ted Leo, if you know Ted Leo, was in Chisel, and I had them play like a whole, and just Ted himself play a bunch of times. His brother was in this band called The Van Pelt. This band called The Dismemberment Plan, which now a lot of people know them, but before they had really almost anything out, they came in, they played four shows. These bands that were really bizarre in a lot of ways, that were doing strange things, that were doing things that weren't just maybe they didn't know how to play their instruments, but that weren't just about not knowing how to play their instruments and expressing anger and a fuck you. It started evolving into this post-punk movement, and those people, this sort of Fugazi, Dismemberment Plan, Shudder to Think, Brainiac, these bizarro bands that were doing weird things that were defying not just the political sphere and culture, but also defying what you would think music should be and what you think art should be. That's where it started getting really potent and powerful for me, and remained in that space for me.
Yeah, Mr. Postmodernist here, this guy talking. has I don't know if it's a contradiction, but I've always had destinations, you know, even though I know they're social constructs, even though I know, like, I've basically been taught or trained or whatever to think in a particular way or to want a thing.
Mm-hmm.
I've always wanted to get somewhere and get it. Mm-hmm. And I'm just saying, my destination was like the black disco club.
Right.
And by the way, I was going to say, like, this is also, so I was attracted as a kid to sort of black working class culture and gay male culture. Mm. Was like, I came to that a little bit later, but like by the time I was in college, I was like, oh yeah, okay, that's what it's about. My politics is best represented by, I don't know if you know this, but like, I'm one of the leading historians of black drag queens. I don't know if you know this, but yeah, like
I knew a little bit about
it. I have a scholarly, big scholarly article written about the history of black drag queens. And you know, I'm friends with the people who make RuPaul's Drag Race. Mm-hmm. But scholarly and just politically, like I was like, oh yeah, that's exactly it. That's what I'm about. Not that it's correct or right or anything. Mm-hmm. It's just that I'm attracted to that. I don't like drag shows. I don't particularly like that aesthetically, but the cultural and sexual politics generally of the drag scene over the last 60 or so years has been about the violation of bourgeois norms, not just to violate them like punk rockers, but to aggrandize myself, one's self. I am beautiful in a way that you don't think is beautiful, but I think is beautiful and my sisters think is beautiful, right? Sisters, of course, meaning the generic form. And celebrating myself and my body is good to me, even though you think it's a bad thing in all sorts of ways.
Yeah.
Right. And there's also, if you look at the drag scene, it's always been phenomenally integrated in every which way. Mm-hmm. Right. So in terms of race, we have like blacks and whites dancing together at big drag balls in Harlem in the 1940s and 1950s, the height of segregation, super integrated. And there were drag kings as well, you know, doing the same thing. There were black drag kings. These were celebrities in the black community. Mm-hmm. And they just didn't care. Same with sex workers, right? And then I became attracted to sex workers after that for the same reasons, because they didn't give a shit. They're already breaking the biggest taboo.
We hang out with each other
too. Yeah, right, yeah. Exactly. So you're breaking the biggest rules to start with. Yeah. So why not just go all the way, which is generally what happens. So you'll see much more crossing of the color line, much, the binary divisions are much softer or more fluid or dissolved entirely in those groups, right? So gays, blacks, and I don't know where you would put, and trans. Mm-hmm. Until now, of course, now trans, the trans movement is breaking my heart, because now what they're doing is reifying the hell out of it. They're saying, oh no, I was born a particular sex, particular gender, right? They're doing what the trans...
Well, some people have it that way and some people don't.
I know,
right?
Yeah. I know.
I think what would break my heart is if, is not that people are doing that. That's fine to me. But if the lesson that the people who aren't doing that were saying was lost, which is that we are not the bodies that you say we are, we decide.
Exactly.
That lesson is, and it's an anti-materialist lesson, which I think is really powerful. And I don't think that lesson will be lost, actually. I think that we'll retain that. And I think that it's a sign, you know, of things that are happening right now. I think it's really profound. Because you did it, I want to do this, which is say what my politics are.
Please.
But I would love people who are listening would do it too. Just like, what is it? Like, could you just say it? You know, I could say in so many different ways, I could say, well, my politics are the occult. You want to know what my politics are? They're the occult. If you don't know what that means or how the occult could be politics, think about it. Like we can have a conversation about it. My politics are, I've said, like, if you want to know my politics, I like sucking dicks and reading books, and I want to do whatever makes those two things more available to everybody and myself. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, I could say, you know, Oscar Wilde once said, I want to learn as much about life from pleasure as other people do from suffering. And to me, that's also my politics. Pleasure is, you know, so frowned upon by so many people. It could be Christian fundamentalists or it could be socialists. Marxists hate pleasure.
Exactly.
They're so suspicious
of
it.
They sure do.
And I think that that's sick and stupid about Marxist movements, because they conflate it with commodity fetish and whatever. I'm not going to get too into my irritation.
Well, no, I'll tell you why. You want to know why? But go ahead. No, go ahead.
but that to me, pleasure, you know, for me, and we talked about this a little bit last time. Sorry, we keep referring to that, guys. But anyway, instead of Marx, choose Fourier. And Fourier is this utopian thinker who said that we could really create a world that was based on pleasure. But what happens if it's pleasure for everybody, not just pleasure for some? And all the sort of crazy things. And he really went far afield. He said planets were bisexual and were having sex with each other, and the oceans were made out of lemonade, and people could have, you know, you probably have a pet giraffe or whatever, and there was a sexual minimum, so everybody got to have a certain amount of sex, and beautiful people had to have sex with ugly people, and there was no monogamy, and, you know, I mean, just this brilliant person. And to me, go there, you know, like Marxism is not enough. For me to use the title of a book by a poet, Laura Riding, anarchism is not enough. It's none of it's enough for me. I want more out of my imagination. And whenever I hit the limit, that's not, I gotta go past it.
You want pleasure. You want more pleasure, and you want other people to have more pleasure.
Yeah.
As they define it?
Yes.
Awesome.
But I will say that I want us to, something I would say is almost an imperative, although no one has an imperative to do anything I fucking say. But it would be great if we could imagine more. Mm-hmm. And if we would stop doing stupid bullshit like, well, I'm going to vote for Hillary Clinton because Donald Trump's like, oh, well, no, not Hillary Clinton, but Bernie Sanders. Oh, well, not Bernie Sanders, but let's all actually just be Marxists. Okay, well, not Marxists. But it's like all these such limited moves. And it's like, man, you realize you can literally think anything. Why the fuck are you thinking this shit?
There you go. So you know what you're sounding like to me? It's the division between the new left, the political new left of the 1960s, and the so-called counterculture of the 1960s. They hated each other. Mm-hmm. So my parents were of the political new left, the ones who were all about, you know, institutions, government, economics, blah, 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 right? The stuff that you were just talking about, often Marxist, not necessarily, but they were into that stuff, the hard stuff, the real stuff, right? The real politics. And they looked down on the hippies across the bay in San Francisco, who were just frolicking in the grass. And gays, they tolerated, but, you know, they were not fans of the clubs and the bathhouses. Because why? Because that's frivolous. It's not about real stuff. It's not about really managing society. It's not about taking responsibility. There's a Puritanism at the heart of all left-wing politics, because it's about managing society, which requires discipline,
right,
and a responsibility. So I have not heard this, anybody except you, ever, maybe, you know, really articulating and standing with those hippies, the counterculture, the gay liberationists, not the guys who wrote the manifestos, although I love them because they said the right things. I'm talking about the guys who were fucking in the backs of trucks in Chelsea.
Fuck yeah,
in 1975.
Totally.
Right? You know about that? You've seen them?
Yeah.
Amazing documentary?
Yeah.
Gay sex in the 70s.
Yeah.
Greatest film ever made.
It's great.
Yeah. So, that's who I'm talking about, right? It's doing exactly what you're not supposed to do, not just to be oppositional, but because you want it.
You actually want
to
do it.
Because you want to suck dick.
Yes.
Right?
That's the principle. It's, you know, how dare you not aspire to have a world that's just an orgy? How dare you? because you fucking want it. Why are you stopping? This is why I find things so reprehensible when people... It's not just that I believe in social justice, so people say trans doesn't exist. I get fucking irritated, and I hate that because people are refusing to imagine more than their stupid ideas.
Right.
And so when we say it's something socially constructed, and people go against that, or they get mad or irritated again about that, I'm like, what the fuck happened to your imagination?
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah. So the closet was a modern invention.
Yes.
It doesn't exist without modernism, because it says that homosexuality is unnatural, right? And so postmodernism, you said it so beautifully right then. It's like, I guess above all else, it's just saying you can think differently. You can want differently.
Yes. And how about this quote from Gilles Deleuze, who I mentioned before, who's basically said that hatred is the destruction or the attempt to destroy difference. So if you want to know where you're at with how well you regard other people, look into your ability to imagine different things. if you can start imagining multiples, crazy variations, all that kind of stuff, if you can get into a total sense of absolute difference everywhere you look, then you really do care about freedom.
Yeah.
If it's a homogenizing thing, whether that comes in the form of free speech, a cry of free speech, or in the in a certain kind of free speech, or if it comes in the form of speech policing, or it comes in the form of certain identities being fixed, or forms, physical forms being fixed, then like you're not doing enough. Then you hate something, and you definitely hate something about yourself.
But you're the devil.
I am.
Here's my last question for you. Are you, so I said that I have mixed feelings about being the devil. My mother said, you're always looking for opposites. You're always looking for the opposite of whatever it is, you know, and she's right. And I am, but then I feel bad about it. I feel like a bad guy. I basically walk around, honestly, feeling like I did something bad and I'm about to be found out for it. And I think it is that, like, it's true. I am always doing something bad because I am always looking for opposites. I'm always asking the questions you're not supposed to ask. Right. And that's what this podcast is about. Are you, do you have any of that ambivalence? Are you just, I mean, so in my straight boy imagination, I think that's why gays have been so attractive. Gay men in particular have been so attractive to me, is because I always imagined them to be, you know, just, and I think this is sort of true in some sense, but you know, just doing what they want to do and without shame, at least since the closet was torn down in 1969, right? Since then, since gay liberation, generally speaking, that's why I've been so attracted to them and found them so heroic, is that they act feminine without shame. When I want to act feminine in some ways and feel terrible about it, they talk about sex when you're not really supposed to talk about sex.
Right.
But anyway, I'm looking for opposites. You do too. Do you ever feel bad in any way?
I did. And I do sometimes, obviously, in personal relationships and stuff like that, where I fuck up and I'm an asshole.
How
or whatever.
How do we do relationships as us? I don't even get it.
Well, but I don't feel bad about my being at all anymore. And that moment with the devil was followed up maybe a couple years later when I found a book, and this will be, I guess, the last story I tell. This book I found in my library. Bizarre that it was there in my middle school library. Curses, hexes, and spells. I stole it because that's what you're supposed to do when you see a book like that. And I went home and tried to summon the devil and created a voodoo doll, tried to turn myself into a cat. I did all the spells in this book. I felt bad about that shit until last year.
Wow.
I carried that, and I was not raised religiously, so I didn't have Christian guilt. I felt badly about that stuff until last year. And my friend Gordon White, who's an occultist, he said to me, he said, oh, you just feel bad because you're racist. And I was like, what? And he's like, don't you get it? In every other culture, every indigenous culture, if you heard something growl at you and then you tried to summon it back up and have some sort of communication with it, like, people would look at you very differently and you would think something very different about yourself because you would be the person that was working with those forces. It's just in this one that even when you're not raised religiously, you still imbibe that shit that mm-hmm. you think that something's bad. So after that, I started to just last year, just talk to the devil, right? Not Satan, the devil. These are two different things in the occult, by the way. But I just started to talk to the devil and just like think, who are you? What are you doing? Were you here to hurt me, or was there something about you that was really important to me? And I used to have this image of God looking down on me and seeing some fuck up distorted thing that did like created a mark on my soul when I was like 8 years old by doing these things, or 9 years old by doing these like spells and hearing the devil and all that kind of stuff. And now I have a vision of being looked upon as someone who is mediating the dark forces that are dark because people don't see or understand in them, and that these forces are also part of the thing that's looking down upon me. So it's all come together, and that's me now.
Wow. Something to aspire to, I think, for me. I don't know what else to say, except thank you.
Yeah, man, this is great. I loved having this conversation with you.
Me too.
Twice.
It's really, yeah, no, it really is just, there's something about you. It's just pure pleasure. Like often, there's going to be some competitiveness when I do this, you know, just sort of, that's just the way I'm built. You know, I try not to be, I try to work against that. I don't know. I mean, I guess there's a little bit of that here, but like,
not really.
It just, it feels like we're just skating.
Yeah.
It's that smooth, like it's just easy. I don't, you know,
yeah, I hope people listening to it feel that way instead of, but you know, it's like, I think this is what happens when two people have a conversation and they're interested in each other. And, I wish more people would do that.
Yeah. Good idea. Right?
Yeah.
All right, man. Thank you.
Yep.
This was the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. Please don't forget to check out unregisteredlisteners.com to support the show. And if you're interested in the special weekend event in Salem, Massachusetts, go to thaddeusrussell.com/courses/weekend. Thanks for listening.